Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hi there again, and welcome back to the Explaining History podcast. Tonight I'm going to be looking at an issue that I think really shapes the early phases of post-war German history. There are some interesting post-war and kind of early Cold War dynamics thrown into it. And that's the issue of displaced persons in Germany and across the rest of Europe. Harald Janer has written a fascinating chapter in his book Aftermath, which I've mentioned before on the podcast. It's really, really worth getting. It takes that 10-year period, 1945 to 1955. And here he talks about the vast number of displaced Europeans in Germany who'd been brought there as essentially slave labourers, the Gastarbeiter, the remaining surviving Jews who emerged from the Nazi death camps, and of course the huge numbers of Germans who had been who had moved to the newly conquered territories across Europe and who had been expelled. And then there were many ethnic Germans who had been, had lived all over Eastern Europe for generations. And at the end of the Second World War, these countries like Czechoslovakia, Poland, places like that, become mono-ethnic nation states. Germans and in some cases other ethnic minorities were forced to leave, but particularly Germans for very good reason. Okay, so Harold Jahner writes, in the summer of 1945, about 75 million people lived in the four occupied zones of Germany. Some 40 million, far more than half of them, were not where they belonged or wanted to be. The war had acted as a powerful mobilisation, dispersal and abduction machine. Anyone who had survived had been spat out by it, somewhere far from where they had went, somewhere far from what had once been their home. The enormous number of 40 million displaced persons included the majority of German soldiers who had become prisoners of war, who numbered over 10 million. Most of them were released in stages between the middle of May 1945 and the end of 1946, apart from the 3.5 million prisoners of war who'd been interned in the Soviet Union, and the 750,000 or so prisoners who had been taken to France. German prisoners of war were stuck in camps all over Europe and the USA, but several million had only been recently imprisoned as the British and Americans advanced on German soil in 1945. Most of them had voluntarily surrendered. Of course, the reason, the motivation for voluntarily surrendering to Western soldiers was so that the inevitable capitulation to the Soviet Union could be avoided. The German soldiers were very, very desperate not to surrender to the Soviets because their future was to be much more brutal in the hands of Soviet captors. They faced a future in slave labour camps in the Soviet Union. And the German prisoners who were captured in the Soviet Union, only a slender number of them, a small percentage of them, were returned back to Germany. In addition, there were 9 million city dwellers who, for fear of air raids, or because they had already been bombed out, had been evacuated to the countryside. Most of them yearned to return to the cities, particularly since the rural population generally hadn't given them an especially warm welcome. Given disruption to traffic networks, however, it was extremely difficult, and in many cases impossible, for them to return. Suitcases were among the most sought-after possessions. There was no point trying to buy them, since in the months of constant back and forth between apartment and air raid seller, they had become scarce commodities. Now, evidence suggests that there is some kind of preparation, some kind of sense, as the war shifts in the direction in the favour of the Allied powers in about 1944, that refugees and displaced persons will have to be catered for and helped. But I don't believe that there's really an appreciation of the scale of the problem that would be encountered. The German economy had run on Gastarbeiters, guest workers, who obviously weren't guests in the conventional sense. German guest workers were, if they were Poles, for example, treated a little better than slave labourers. If they were French or Belgian, treated as kind of, exceedingly poorly paid workers. And the whole point about kind of German economic imperialism during the war years, and this is what the model for Germany would have been like after the war, had Germany won, was to fuel a German economic boom based on incredibly cheap or free labour. German living standards were set to skyrocket, based on German farms and German factories having this influx of virtually free, or in many cases completely free, labour. The conditions in which they were kept were pretty dire. There was a study done it must be about a decade ago now, which revealed that there are far more work camps for the Gastarbeiter than were previously thought. When one thinks about the German camps, one thinks about concentration and death camps, but these were massively, massively outnumbered by barracks for workers from all over Europe who were taken to Germany, some who had no choice than to voluntarily go to Germany because of the poverty in their own countries as a result of German occupation. And the conditions that they're kept in are slightly better than those in a concentration camp, but not much better. There's not really in the normal kind of process of or kind of practice of migratory work in more freer circumstances is one sends home a remittance, one sends back to one's home country wages to one's family. If obviously this isn't possible in wartime Germany, because whatever the Gastarbeiter are paid, in some cases not paid at all, was barely enough to buy the basics to survive on. And as the war gets more and more out of favour for Germany, as the war slips out of Germany's favour, there are shortages, there is hunger, and there is danger and risk from Allied bombing. There are between 8 and 10 million prisoners who have been torn from their homelands and forced into concentration and labour camps within Germany, from which they had now been liberated. Most of them only had the clothes on their backs. Their release did not assure the prisoners a homecoming, even if their homes still existed. Some had the good fortune to be provided with food by Allied soldiers immediately after liberation and returned to their homeland shortly afterwards. Those who were less fortunate were left to wander through the defeated country, whose inhabitants had recently enslaved them and in many cases murdered their families. But most people waited, weak and dispirited, in new camps or even in old ones to see what fate had in store for them. A further 12.5 million people drifted through Germany in groups of various sizes. Exiles from the eastern territories that were now no longer German, mostly passing through regions that were unfamiliar to them and in which it was made very clear they were not welcome. They had no choice but to find a place to where they could stay. On the day of Germany's capitulation, responsibility for all these people fell formally to four Allied powers, a total of 40 million people uprooted in one way or another in the four occupied zones. Refugees, abductees, deserters, the homeless, then stranded. It was forced relocation on an unimaginable scale. That's not to say that everyone was actually in motion. Most people stayed right where they were, holding out in camps and only moving on painfully slowly or with significant delays. Some had to be returned home as quickly as possible, while others first had to be placed in custodial care. They all needed to be fed, a gigantic logistical effort at a time when even the barest necessities could not be sourced. The number of German prisoners of war needing to be interned temporarily was so great from April 1945 onwards that the Allies saw no other possibility but to fence in about a million of them in the so-called Rheinweichenlager fence, the Rhine Meadow camps, forcing them to spend many weeks behind barbed wire beneath the open sky. It was only over the course of June 1945 that most of the 23 camps received latrines, kitchens with roofs and infirmaries. By September 1945, the last of these mass camps was dissolved after most of the inmates had been questioned and released or else distributed among smaller POW camps and former forced labour camps. It becomes quite easy to see how a majority of Germany's war criminals managed to evade justice. In those sorts of conditions, the high profile war criminals. Obviously, there's a, as if you might have listened to my interview with Guy Walters the other year, a majority of the more high profile war criminals managed to escape to places like Uruguay and Bolivia and Argentina. However, there were the vast numbers of the kind of like the lower and middle tier of war criminals, Wehrmacht soldiers who had committed atrocities in Poland and Russia, who simply are never prosecuted. The chaos of the time means it's virtually impossible to compile evidence against them. There is the need to quickly dissolve these camps, to send the men home as much in whatever way possible, unless there is somebody there at the time with some kind of compelling case that this is somebody that needs to be arrested and by military police and prosecuted. Often soldiers would change their names or find other ingenious ways within the camps to hide their identities. And there is the infrastructure for mass prosecution isn't there, and it's not in many cases even seen as desirable, because the Allied powers are aware that Germany will have to start functioning again pretty soon, and that managing and occupying Germany for too long and enforcing a victor's justice on Germany might well have all sorts of negative consequences. These soldiers, often crammed together in hundreds and thousands, squatted on the ground and exposed to the elements, offered a shocking symbol of the sheer indistinguishable human mass to which the Nazi regime and the war had reduced society. Many living outside the fences didn't fare much better. Anyone who travelled during this time would have seen wandering people on the streets and stations, station platforms and in waiting rooms. The journalist Ursula von Kardorf saw the misery at Halle railway station in September 1945. Terrible images, rubble, amongst which wander creatures that seem no longer to be of this world, homecomers in ragged, wadded uniforms covered with boils, creeping along makeshift crutches, living corpses. 45% of all dwellings were destroyed. In the cities, millions of people were homeless and moved on temporary from one temporary habitation to the next. They slept in allotment plots with relatives in cramped apartments, in bunkers or outside any park benches that had not been broken up for firewood. Others simply lay down just off the road, often in basement doorways or under bridges, or found shelter in the rubble despite the threat of collapse from ruined buildings. All of these were easy prey for criminals. The police statistics for crimes of theft leapt up by 800%, because people saw little point in reporting crimes in real the real numbers will likely be much higher. Many people in the big cities adapted to the black market. In Cologne, British soldiers happened upon a group of 60 people who'd formed a criminal gang. They'd accessed enough food for several months from the basement of a department store and stored it in the city's labyrinthine catacombs. They did a vigorous underground trade with the surplus. In Munich, a number of resourceful people had opened up the staff area in the basement of the ruined Regina Hotel to use as an emergency shelter. All around the former swimming pool, there were changing cabins and white-covered lounges. Running water still came from taps, and even the showers worked. The group met up for breakfast in the former ironing room and devoured whatever they had scavenged on trips throughout the city in the previous day. Of course, one great place to acquire surplus supplies from were the occupying armies themselves. Some soldiers would sell excess rations or trade excess rations for items they thought were valuable, often memorabilia they wished to take home, or some would be sympathetic. Others could be bribed and simply poorly guarded stockpiles of food and other items could be looted by the desperate, and often were. Obviously, this is a lot harder in the Soviet section, where the consequences for looting were much, much worse. Others were stuck in less comfortable accommodation. Station waiting rooms were notorious collecting tanks. Sooner or later, even the most affluent travellers were bound to share sleeping spaces on the floor with the people who lived there, because the few trains running were often delayed for days. Everyone was out in the streets all the time, not least in search of news. Without a working postal and telephone service, all communication had to be done on foot. In the anxious chaos of the post-war months, news was a vitally important commodity. If you wanted to find out who was alive and who was still missing, what goods could be got hold of and where, you had to go out and look. The situation was far from clear, the supply chains were broken, so it was of vital importance to leave messages about one's whereabouts and let others know one was still alive. Anyone who moved house wrote their new address on the doors of the abandoned ruins. Heinz Seibert is living in Wedding at 98 Soldener Street with the Winzer family. People hungry for any kind of tips on information paid visit after visit, swapping tales and experiences. Getting hold of the bearish necessities involved long journeys through every part of town. So this was the result of 12 years of Nazism. Hitler, as we know, had planned for 1,000 years of Nazism, a 1,000-year Reich. But it just took 12 to reduce the most advanced, modern, dynamic, industrialized state in Europe to anarchy and chaos. And in a way, fascism kind of, whilst promising order, seems only capable of delivering different kinds of chaos as its focus on endless engendered struggle and dynamism and the battle of the wills and all this kind of ludicrous rhetoric really tends to lead to. The level of chaos is interesting and it's kind of captured here when Harold Janer writes, "Documentary footage from the summer of 1945 in Berlin shows everyone charging about in all directions. Russian and American soldiers, German police, gangs of youths, families dragging belongings through the streets on handcarts, scruffy homeowners, invalids on crutches, smart-suited men, cyclists in collar and tie, women with empty rucksacks, women with full rucksacks, and certainly many more women than men. Some stroll about, others hurry along single-mindedly, clearly seeking to make contact, urgently in need of food or a roof over their heads. For some, their normal everyday life seems to have been barely affected, while others wander distractedly through the streets, still searching for a place to stay. The social differences are vast. While scattering groups cook scraps of food on little flickering fires on pavements beneath the open sky before squatting on the curb to eat them, only 5 weeks after the end of the war, others are sitting in cafes on the Kafirstendamm, watching people strolling along the boulevard as they always have done." And I think that little vignette is really interesting, in that whilst you have this terrible squalor and deprivation, there are always those in these circumstances who find the wherewithal to relax and enjoy the finer things of life. Germany was very quickly able to mobilise its resources and to restore aspects of everyday life quite quickly. The cafes, the hotels, the bars, the cinemas, these kinds of things. So you wind up with this kind of very paradoxical situation that in the heart of total anarchy, with a country that's divided into four zones, a country that kind of, as a state, doesn't exist anymore for a while, that's occupied by four allied powers. it's people still managing to quickly bring back aspects of the everyday. And this is how human beings are, in a way. Even in the most difficult of times, they find ways in which to restore fragments of normality. And the problem with all of this, particularly with Germany, is that even those who were sitting in on the Kaffeestandam, enjoying coffee, knew about the Holocaust. This open secret, as Richard J. Evans put it, was something that everybody knew about, and the only people that professed to not know were the ones who didn't wish to know. But it, with the knowledge of it is so widespread, it's almost unavoidable. And this new society that would spring from the ashes of the war would have to contend with this horrific legacy of this national guilt. And as we look further into Harold Janer's book, and this is a particular topic I am very curious about, German historical memory, we'll explore more ways in which Germany contended with and sometimes failed and sometimes succeeded in coming to terms with the legacies of Nazism. Anyway, I hope you find this useful and helpful, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.